from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Marilyn, Mao, Jackie Kennedy, Campbell's soup cans, Coke bottles, car crashes. It's the pop art parade of Andy Warhol. He was the pop genius of the 60s, the crazy-haired poor boy from Pittsburgh gone superstar. Andy Warhol changed art with his big silk screens, bold colors, simple, potent subjects. He was the American mirror. A new exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York looks at his influence on artists who followed. My guests today say he changed the way we all see the world. This hour on Point, the Andy Warhol legacy. You can join the conversation. Did you? Do you? Love Warhol? The famous faces, the wild colors, the repetition. What did Andy Warhol invite us to see? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's hear that famous voice. This is an interview, March 1981, with BBC Radio 4. Andy Warhol talking about what he tried to achieve in portraiture of the famous and why there was so much repetition in his work.
I try to make people look good. I try to do big, simple, simple designs, mostly.
Why do you so often repeat the image?
I always think I don't do the first one good, so I try to do it more, you know. I mean, in portraits, that's what I did. And then I try to do them over, and then after a while, you know, you have more than one. It takes me more time to do.
You do them over, and after a while you have more than one. It's kind of a Zen cone. Andy Warhol right there. Joining us now from New York is Marla Prather, curator of modern and contemporary art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. She's brought together big exhibits on Ellsworth Kelly, William de Kooning, Picasso, and more. Her new exhibit, co-curated with Mark Rosenthal, is titled Regarding Warhol, 60 Artists, 50 Years. Marla Prather, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here, Tom.
And from New York, Peter Sheldahl joins us, art critic, writer, big thinker at The New Yorker. He's been thinking about Andy Warhol for a while now. His latest essay and review of the exhibit is Going Pop, Warhol and His Influence. Peter Sheldahl, thanks for being here. Welcome back to On Point, Peter.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So there's that flat Warhol voice. It's there in his affect whenever he's interviewed, and it's kind of there in his art as well, isn't it, Peter?
It's absolutely consistent. He was completely of a piece.
You call him of a piece, sort of what you say, heralding the elite culture, the collapse of the elite culture into mass culture, of creativity into commerce, of reality into the appearance of reality. That's pretty big stuff.
It was revolutionary, of course, out of the collapse of elite culture came a new elite culture.
How,
which is on display at the Metropolitan Museum.
We're going to look at that exhibit. How does a guy who puts Coke bottles and Campbell's soup cans and silk screens of Marilyn up on the wall bring down all of that elite culture, creativity into commerce, reality itself into the appearance? What's the mechanism that was at work here?
Well, it was an historical development that would have happened anyway. Of a vastly expanded audience, multiplication of communication, all the usual sociological bromides for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
As you said at your introduction, he was a mirror, and he was a perfect mirror, unflawed.
Marta, we'll look at those who came after. You pose them sort of as descendants in one way or another of Andy Warhol. But what about the protean man himself? You've got 45 of his works up at the Met right now. What do you see in 2012 when you look back at this tremendous wave of Andy Warhol works that started coming out of the early 60s? What do you see? What's it say to you today, Marta?
Well, actually, we have 51,
51
works by
okay.
51.
Okay.
The numbers in the show kept growing.
Okay.
In fact, the original title of the show was 50 Artists, 50 Years, and then we realized
okay.
we were creeping
right,
above 50 and finally got to 60, and it wasn't easy limiting it to 60. And within those 51 works by Warhol in the exhibition, it's almost like a kind of mini retrospective. There are certain aspects of the career that are not well represented, but one does have this ability in this show to look at works beginning in 1961 all the way to the last decade of his life. And And I see many things. And working on the show, I was struck again and again by his prescience, by his clairvoyance, by his anticipation of so much that has happened since. But I also learned again what a really good artist he is, and not just because of his fantastic images, and we think of him as a great producer of imagery, but the way he made the images, the fact that he was a really, really good painter.
A lot of people will hear that and think, wait a minute, I thought he took photographs and did silk screens and did them again and did them again. A really, really good painter in what sense, Marla?
Well, I think there is this misguided notion that Warhol, who said he wanted to be like a machine, actually produced art in a kind of mechanical way. And it's true that in 1962, not only was he painting commercial kinds of images, he adopted the technique of photo silkscreen from advertising and commercial printing. But he worked like a demon. He was very hands-on. He painted. He applied paint. He was a great designer of images, but he was a great colorist, which I think Peter could especially talk about. So the sense that these images were just kind of coming out of a conveyor belt, I think, is completely wrong. And when you look at the surface of the paintings, there's real paint there. And in the interviews that I did for the exhibition catalog with various artists in the exhibition, that's one question I always wanted to ask painters. What do you think of Warhol as a painter? And they think he's a good painter for the most part.
Well, it's not Rembrandt, but it's different. Well, what do you say, Peter?
No, but I think you know, Rembrandt sufficiently brought up to date or approved. He's in command of all of the aspects of what a painting is. I mean, artists really face two kinds of choices: what to put in and what to leave out. And Warhol, like other artists before him, Mondrian, left out more than seemed plausible, but what remained gained in power from it. But in terms of scale, surface, facture, color, all of the elements of a work on canvas, he was in complete control.
We'll look at the elements there. What about the subjects themselves, Peter? I mean, celebrities and soup cans.
Well, not to get too involved in and the point, but I mean, I say that there's a sort of alien quality to Warhol and the culture. I mean, it seemed, where did he come from? Well, he came from the lower working class, Slovakian immigrants. Mm-hmm. As a child, he was a sort of sissy kid who was beloved of his family and fascinated by celebrity and you know, the popular culture, which he viewed from below, by happenstance and luck and genius, he brought that view to the top of society. He always had the whole culture in front of him. He was sort of 360 degrees marginal. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I'm trying to get 360 degrees around that. I mean, you say that with that working class sort of bottom rung Pittsburgh, I think his dad was a coal miner for a while their life. And then he goes to New York, becomes a graphic artist and sort of catapults very quickly up into superstardom, that he sort of missed the typical American progression here. There was no middle class about him. What did that mean, Peter?
Well, it meant no irony. Which was mystified everyone. They were always looking for what Andy Warhol was really saying, but what he said was absolutely obvious and uninflected by irony. And that made him seem Martian.
Marlo, if it's not irony, what is going on? I mean, he doesn't just put a photograph of a Coke bottle. He's treating the bottle. He's repeating it, I don't know, here it looks like 100 times or something. I mean, there's some, is it just presentation? Is it just, here's the surface, look at it, I'm Andy Warhol, goodbye?
No, I think that in those early images of soup cans and Coke bottles and Brillo boxes and Heinz ketchup boxes, there is this wonderful sense of egalitarianism. I mean, he is really painting the very substances that he drank, that he ate for lunch, that he saw in the supermarket, and that the idea that these were sufficiently important enough to paint is really one of his great contributions. He obviously recognized their incredible graphic success and appeal. The Coca-Cola emblem, Campbell's Soup, is one of the most enduring graphic images. They're very iconic in their own way, and he seized upon that. But he said, you know, a Coke is a Coke, and you can't, no matter who you are, you can't buy a better Coke. Whether you're Liz Taylor or you're the president, you're going to drink the same Coke that the bum on the corner is drinking.
Right, right. Or a coal miner. Marla Prather with the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Peter Sheldahl with The New Yorker. Please stand by. We're talking this hour about pop icon artist Andy Warhol. You can join us. Did you, do you love Warhol? What was he saying with all those silkscreen celebrities and everyday objects? Here's Andy Warhol, David Bowie. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Andy Warhol, looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
We're talking this hour about pop icon, artist Andy Warhol, impresario of Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, Mao, Campbell Soup Cans, himself, and how he changed the way we see the world. Marla Prather is with us from the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Big new exhibit there just up regarding Warhol, 60 artists, 50 years, looking at his impact on art and artists who came behind. Peter Sheldahl is with us from The New Yorker magazine. His essay this week is Going Pop, Warhol and His Influence. He sees it as big. What about you? Did you see him as a genius, as a joker? What was he saying, showing with all those silkscreen Marilyns and soup cans, his Brillo box, Elvis, Mao? Do we all see the world like Andy Warhol now, fascinated and detached? He was famously sort of Sphinx-like in his own interviews. Here he is, 1964, giving a kind of unceremonious and slightly awkward interview about pop art.
Andy, do you feel that the public has insulted your art?
No.
Why not?
Well, I hadn't thought about it.
It doesn't bother you at all, then?
No.
Well, do you think that they've shown a lack of appreciation for what pop art means?
No.
Do you think it should break away from being pop art?
No.
Are you just going to carry on?
Yes.
yes, no. Peter Sheldahl, is that performance art right there in the interview?
No, he's absolutely sincere and honest. I think the middle class culture we come up in always assumes that there's something unsaid, so that we can't believe him when he says something directly and flatly.
So if he just directly and flatly brought us what he had in mind, showed it to us, and yet you say he changed the way we all see the world, or did he change it, or
well,
did he
it,
sort of catch the wave ahead of us?
It's hard to tell. He put his brand on the way the world changed and would have changed without him. Were Marilyn, Elvis, soup cans, the inevitable images? There's no way of telling. I mean, they were once he chose them.
But when you say what was the change? Whether it's him or all of us kind of heading that way and him out front, what was the texture, the nature of that change?
I think it was media culture would be the short answer. I mean, a standard way of an old way of describing art is holding up a mirror to nature. He held up a mirror to culture, where common experience was displaced from direct experience of the world into images and media.
So it's kind of intermediated. You say he's like rock and roll. In what way?
Well, because it's aggressively engaging. I mean, Elvis, you know, Elvis was a weird kid. I think, you know, why is he global? Why do young people all around the world, particularly in emerging cultures, you know, immediately identify with him? And my notion is that he shows a really fast way of being normal without having to give up being weird.
You mean Elvis or Andy in that case?
Andy. And Elvis. I mean, and rock and roll. You know, that is, you know, that culture wasn't something you had to aspire to or educate yourself for. You had it already. You were right there. Go out in the garage, get a guitar.
Just put it right there. Here he is in 1981 saying that even emotion, feelings, not important, just put it out there. And this is a BBC interview again.
Do you believe in feelings and emotions?
Well, no, I don't, but I have them. I wish I didn't.
But you'd like to get rid of them altogether, would you?
Would be a good idea, yeah.
Just roll the silk screen. Kobe's calling from Winchester, Massachusetts. Kobe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot. I'm really fascinated by the kind of every commercial is art, all art is commercial element of Warhol, and it really strikes me how established that is in marketing today. I mean, we sit around the TV during the Super Bowl and watch this series of surrealist shorts that I think really could have taken Dali by surprise.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of waiting for that same standard to take hold in political marketing, that, you know, we kind of respect the artistic elements of a presidential campaign the way Warhol respected the artistic element of a commercial campaign. And, you know, the notion that all art is political isn't anything new. But I'm hoping that the kind of the Shepherd Fairey Hope poster is only the beginning of seeing all things political as art themselves.
Commerce, politics, roll it all right in there. Marla Prather, many people have commented in these recent years about that Shepherd Fairey Obama Hope poster, saying, well, hey, you want to see an echo of Andy Warhol, there it is.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is in many ways Warholian. It certainly has a kind of Warhol style to it with its kind of sharp-edged, high-keyed color. And it also is an appropriated image. And although Warhol wasn't the only appropriator, he certainly was a very important pioneer in that way. He wasn't a political artist, but I think he did make politically charged works occasionally. And he even ventured into politics in the sense that he made an anti-Nixon poster in favor of McGovern.
What else was politically charged? Do you mean the electric chair? I don't know, Mao Zedong? Are those politics?
I mean, I think the electric chair certainly. I don't think that it was violence per se that appealed to him. It was always current events. He was reading the papers, he was reading magazines constantly, and he was paying attention to what was happening in the culture. And he made electric chairs in 1963, the last year that New York State executed prisoners at Sing Sing Prison. So it's not just an image, it was a very timely image. And he understood that he could paint this image and create a haunting, mysterious image about death that we find very, very alluring and strange.
Orange.
I think he was interested in the energy in the image, you know, and if it was political, that was fine. I think he didn't care about politics really at all. I mean, to the extent that he couldn't be bothered to be apolitical, if he found himself in a situation that called for a campaign poster, he was fine with that.
Just go with the energy of the image, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. I mean, Marla,
And with Mao, I mean, you know, again, it had to do with the daily news. It had to do with Nixon going to China. Mao was very much in the news. He read in Life magazine that Mao was the most famous person in the world. So he found Mao an irresistible subject, and he made about 200 paintings of him.
So, but what is it that he's doing, Peter, when he picks up something like Mao? And you look across these images, there are so many that were already incredibly potent, iconic images before he gave his tweak to them. I mean, there's Mao, you know, in Tiananmen, right up on the front of the Forbidden City. Everybody's seen that. There's Marilyn Monroe. What more famous face could you ask for, photographed and all over the place? What's that tweak that Warhol brought to it that made you step back and say, oh?
He represented the image. He didn't represent the person. It's like at a it's like an iconic image that comes from a photograph that's reproduced, a degraded photograph turned into a silkscreen, decorated with painterly colors. It's like many many levels removed from any reality, but there is that connection, and it's a force field. I mean, but it's. He didn't paint Marilyn Monroe. He painted an image of Marilyn Monroe, and it seems like a kind of academic point, but it's, I think, essential to the mysteriousness and power.
So is this where the detachment comes in? If he's changed the way we all see the world, we're not seeing the actual, I don't know, the person, the soul. We're seeing the image, and we're...
Well, we always were, you know, but when we looked at an image, Warhol brought it to consciousness and made it the basis for an aesthetic.
Jill,
but he did choose to paint Marilyn literally the day she died.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't pick up that subject of her great celebrity until she was gone.
Uh-huh.
And it was actually a friend who suggested, you know, why not paint Marilyn? And he even said, he called his series of car crashes and electric chairs and suicides and so forth. At one point, he called it the series Death in America. And he said that Marilyn was part of his Death in America series. And so it was the tragedy of her death that I think also appealed to him, not just her beauty and fame.
That's a good point. And, you know, when I think, I mean, death is, I mean, what we're talking, a person turned into an image and an image of an image. It's a kind of death, you know, and... it's part of the gravity. I mean, there's a seriousness about it. You know, it's not jokey. You know, it's you want to think it's jokey, but you forget to laugh.
There's that famous Julian Schnabel quote where he says there's something at the bottom of all his work that is absolutely heartbreaking. Unfunny or heartbreaking, Peter?
I don't think there's any bottom to his work.
But there are heartbreaking aspects to it and images and you know, one thinks of him painting Jackie. He painted Jackie Kennedy. He painted her in happy moments, but he didn't take on the subject until her husband was assassinated. And I don't think one can look at the images of Jackie pre and post assassination and not be moved by them, not be touched by them.
Mm-hmm. There's the smile, but with a different meaning after events. Greenwich, Connecticut. Richard is calling. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I might be completely wrong about this, but I believe I heard years ago that Andy Warhol was the most prolific American artist in terms of the production of artwork with religious themes. First, is that true? And secondly, if it is, how come it seems like you never see any of it?
Well, I guess it depends what is. How you define religious. Marla, what do you think? Religious themes in Warhol.
He absolutely did paint religious subjects. He grew up in a very religious family. They were a Ruthenian, really a kind of close to Russian Orthodox church. And he claimed to be a religious person, even though he sometimes said he didn't believe in God. But part of
his... I read
his
somewhere that he went to the cathedral every day, sat in the back pew. I don't know if it's true.
He did, and went often with his mother, Julia. But particularly later in life, he painted religious subjects, and I think it's interesting. There are a lot of religious subjects and subjects about death in the later portion of his career.
What constitutes a religious subject for Warhol?
Well, because he appropriated other images, he painted many, many paintings of Leonardo's Last Supper, both details and gigantic versions of it. camouflaged versions of it, painted the Madonna after Raphael. So there are a number of and the reason your caller makes the point is not that there were that many subjects, but he made so many of the few subjects that he – and, of course, no one was painting religious subjects at that point in American painting.
Is there a contradiction, Peter, in religious subjects in Coke bottles, or is there some continuity there?
There's some continuity. I mean, the very idea of the icon, you know, and Eastern Orthodox. There's a Byzantine element mm-hmm. to Warhol. Mm-hmm. And there is a kind of veneration which is not personal, but it's engulfing. And he brought it to Coke bottles and to the Madonna.
We're talking about the legacy of Andy Warhol with Marla Prather of the Met in New York and Peter Sheldahl of the New Yorker magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. East Berkshire, Vermont, Tim is calling. Hi, Tim. Thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question simply is, who came first, Roy Lichtenstein or Andy Warhol? And furthermore, did they ever have any type of a interaction or relationship, albeit professional or otherwise?
The comics, the cartoon Roy or Andy, Peter, what about it?
Oh, I think they were simultaneous. I mean, Andy Warhol was desperate for Leo Castelli Gallery to show him in 62. And Leo said, sorry, we already got somebody doing that. And it was Roy Lichtenstein. That's where Andy found out about Roy.
What do they mean by doing that?
Comic strips. Andy was doing comic strips, which is when he discovered his Roy Lichtenstein, he stopped doing them.
Marla, so he turned, as you say, to news in part, just to images that were everywhere.
That's right. His earliest images were, you know, Superman comics and so forth. And the moment he saw Lichtenstein's paintings and was, as Peter said, rejected by Leo Castelli, he changed his subject matter.
Peter, was he conscious of trying to do something? I mean, he wanted to make a living. He was very keen on that, made quite a handsome living.
Well, he wanted to be rich and famous. I mean, he thought that was what it was about. If you're American, you became rich and famous.
Marla, did
it was
that,
very straightforward.
Is that part of his legacy, Marla, and the artists that followed him, that, you know, not just to make art, but to be rich and famous?
Oh, it's certainly part of his legacy. It didn't all come automatically, though. Remember, he came to New York from Pittsburgh in 1949. He was a very, very precocious artist. I mean, took lessons starting at age 9, but worked his way into New York as a graphic artist. So from 49 to really his first public exhibition in a store window in 1961, you know, that's over a decade. And he was a very successful graphic artist, but I wouldn't want your listeners to think that there was no struggle, because I think there certainly was. But then there did come a point, particularly in the 1970s, when he began to do commissioned portraits of the jet set. He really was a member of that very glamorous world, and he was by then also quite wealthy. And it's certainly part of his legacy, but it's also, I think, part of the reason that Warhol has had his detractors over the years. We're not certain that we really like to have very rich and glamorous artists.
Do the artists, we'll talk about the artists that you follow in his wake, do they try to separate themselves from that desire for fame and wealth, or embrace it, Marla, or is it all?
I think every artist functions in a different way, and one can't say sort of universally what I think most artists want is to make their art and then for the art to be seen.
Well, there's Warhol, all that, plus wealth and fame. Here's Movement 8 and 9, minimalist composer John Cale, heavily influenced by the work of Warhol, recorded this live score in 1994 for Warhol's early 60s film Kiss. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about pop icon, artist Andy Warhol, impresario of Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, Mao, Campbell's soup cans, himself, and how he changed the way we see the world. Marla Prather is with us. Her big new exhibit at the Met in New York, curated with Mark Rosenthal, is Regarding Warhol, 60 Artists, 50 Years, opened this week to the public. You can see a gallery of images from that display at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter Sheldahl is with us, art critic and writer for The New Yorker. His recent essay on this going pop Warhol and his influence. Here's Andy Warhol again, 1981, kind of inimitable voice, talking with BBC 4 Radio, giving a very nuts and bolts take on his artistic process, starting with the number of photos he'll take in one sitting.
I take at least 200, or maybe more. But then I pick, and sometimes I take a half a picture from one picture and another picture, a lip from another picture. It's usually a colored picture, and I turn it into a black and white photograph. And then from there I turn it into, you blow it up to the size. I guess I got stuck to making all the pictures 40 inches by 40 inches, so I blow up to a 40 by 40. And then I have a silk screen made of it, and then I put the paint on, then I paint over it, and try to get the right colors, and sometimes it's hard, but sometimes it's easy.
Sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's easy. There in 1981. In 1971, just a short one here, Andy Warhol on why he thought pop art started to rise in the early 1960s.
I think we just read a lot of comic books, and it just happened to come out then.
Well,
because comic books make things the way they are really today. I mean, the way things happen in New York now, it's like being in a Western movie.
Andy Warhol, 1971. Marla Prather is with us. Peter Sheldahl, Virginia Beach, Virginia. Jason is calling. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you think?
I don't get it. I understand that, you know, he's an artist and does things through his inspiration with his own filter, but it's almost upsetting to me when I hear people talking about how great of an artist he was or what his contribution was. I just don't get it in any way.
Does it not even look cool to you? It looks pretty cool to me.
And that's my personal preference as far as it looks cool or not, but it's the kind of thing, like his art, honestly, if my kids came home with it, similar stuff, I'd hang it up. But as far as it being something that speaks to me or is really impressive or even makes a bold statement, I don't get that at all.
Jason, I appreciate your call. Marla, it's so interesting. Here we are decades after. I'm sure there was that kind of response in 1961, 1962, to the extent there was response. There's a lot more over the years. Here we are half a century later and still getting that, even as, you know, you've got them all over the Met. How do you reconcile those, Marla?
Warhol has always had his detractors. He still does, and he did in the early 60s. The critical response was not immediately positive. Certainly people saw it as abject. You know, the subject matter was too low culture, too low brow. Where was the high, but only the low? And so I think that there are a lot of people who, you know, don't appreciate Warhol. I mean, I wish I could walk your listener through the exhibition and get a chance to talk about things in front of pictures. But
I do wonder, Peter.
Okay. I do wonder if the caller has seen Warhol paintings in person. Perhaps he has. And I think a kind of initial negative reaction is entirely legitimate to something this jolting. I just encourage people to stick around, have another reaction. Maybe they'll end up hating it more, but they'll be more articulate.
Give it a try, Jason. Put your thumb out. Get up to New York. I have to say there's some real potency there. You stand and you look and
the physical scale of them is absolutely essential. When you, I mean, it's in a way, it's it's a complete distortion to reproduce a Warhol. It's like, you know, the painting is the end of a reproduction process, and then being returned to reproduction, it loses a lot.
But in fairness to Jason and others who share that view, I mean, you say, Peter, you write that Warhol unraveled any received sense of what artists are and do. Describe that mm-hmm. unraveling. What was left on the other side of that unraveling?
Well, art. I mean, it reconstituted, but at a different level. I mean, the thing about money and fame, that was part of his candor. I mean, everybody has always wanted money and fame. It was an unspeakable desire in the avant-garde tradition, and only freaks like Salvador Dali, you know, would make a show of it. And he made it absolutely matter of fact. I mean, money and fame have not been the same since Warhol. I mean, it's they've become common currency. It was, it was shocking at the time. He's shocking.
And he made himself part of that very flow of his own art. You can see the silk screen of him right in there as well. Lexington, Kentucky. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Peter, I was actually in your apartment years ago on St. Mark's Place talking to you about some art. But one of my comments is, what do you think about the legacy of Andy Warhol? I mean, compare Andy Warhol, top of the line, top of his game for the 20th century and continuing today, compared to someone like Meissonier, who's a French painter of the 19th century, selling for the highest prices and making all kinds of awards and honorary claims and all sorts of things about his career. I'm an artist. I used to have an art gallery in the East Village, and mm-hmm. so I'm familiar with the Warhol scene. Got to meet Andy Warhol at a party, and one of his clones. He had people dressed up looking like him, traveling around the country, doing speaking engagements at the universities and things like that, but which was kind of fun, right? But his legacy, I mean, and time sort of has a way of deciding who's important later on. I mean, he's still a New York icon, that's for sure, in terms of the New York art world. Many people feel a lot of affection for him.
Yeah, let us pick it up, Chris. It's a good question. Peter, how do you stack up?
I think the verdict is in. I mean, after 50 years, he is supreme in the way that Picasso was for the first half of the 20th century and still is in aspect of painting. Comparing him to Meissonier, who is an academic warhorse painter of warhorses in the 19th century is pejorative, and no. Andy's around, and it's not just in New York. It's global.
Marley,
China.
Yeah, look all over. Definitely there. That's the echo back. Even in China, you can find that image. Marla, you're the curator here. Stacking up and comparing and contrasting is your job. You've got the exhibit, so does that mean, I mean, he's been a made man for a while, but what about the weight, the stature of that legacy?
Well, I hope that the exhibition makes that point, that one great measure of any artist's achievement, it seems to me, is what he then leaves for other artists to pick up on, to develop, to challenge. And I think that this exhibition really proves that that legacy is alive and well. And the phenomenon of Warhol, I would also direct people to the catalog. There's a fascinating timeline that was put together by Rebecca Lowry just about the phenomenon of Warhol up until the present. You know, it didn't fade with his death in 1987. Mm-hmm. It's actually, I think, gotten stronger. His presence in the culture at large, not simply within the world of museums and New York and the fine arts, but really everywhere, in advertising, in fashion. He is ubiquitous.
You've got Gerhard Richter there in his wake, and Sigmar Polkin, Cindy Sherman, Jeff Koons. I mean, Peter, when you look at those that the Met has chosen to say, well, these kind of flow in the wake of Warhol, is it obvious to you who's in and who's out of that wake?
Well, it's an exciting show to me, just in terms of getting everybody together in the same room. It's like the last scene in an Agatha Christie novel.
Yeah, you know,
like,
yeah.
And all the suspects. And seeing how they stack up. And in terms of really understanding and comprehending the revolutionary meaning of Warhol's work for the Western tradition in painting, I think Gerhard Richter and Sigmar Polka got it in the 60s. We didn't get them until around 1980. We didn't even see their work. Mm-hmm. We weren't looking to Germany. They stand up extremely powerfully. I think Cindy Sherman stands up very powerfully as someone who addressed the conflation of photography and painting that Warhol, you know, made, which you can't get around since then, by extracting the painting part.
Cindy Sherman, who takes on these personas
having
and photographs herself.
Having photographs that are like paintings, that are purely intentional, purely constructed, that have the presence and the tradition of painting. Yeah, I mean, those are the strongest artists. I mean, there are many marvelous artists in the show, and some that don't hold up so well, but that's the fun.
You write, Peter, that Warhol was so clairvoyant an artist that he scarcely needed to be a great one, though you say he was that too. Clairvoyant of what? What was it that he saw?
Well, he did. You know, it's who was it said? I think it's you know, that 90% of everything is seeing what's in front of your nose, but the trick is knowing where to point it, where to point the nose. He had an absolutely clear view of what was happening and in the culture. Well, that made him authoritative.
Was it a positive thing happening, a negative thing happening? Was it a loss of integrity that took us to the surface?
Oh,
loss
it was. It was. You can read it up one side and down the other. I mean, sure, there's a lot of negative. There's tremendous losses. The losses didn't bother Warhol. The gains didn't especially impress him. He just told the truth.
Talking about Andy Warhol and his legacy, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jill is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Jill. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm an artist, and I listen to your show all the time in my studio while
great,
I'm working.
Great. Happy to picture it.
I just wanted to comment when somebody mentioned about Warhol not being ironic. I think that's an important thing for people to remember when they're looking at contemporary art, because I think a lot of viewers have the sense that contemporary art is trying to pull something over on the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have found when I look at a lot of art, and I found when I do that, and I keep in mind that there's a very good chance that this artist is being sincere, then I like it a lot more. You know, if Warhol's painting a soup can because he thinks soup cans are cool and they have great graphics, then if I know the intent, it makes me appreciate the work a lot more.
So accept the genuine quality of the intent and what it deepens for you.
Yeah. If I don't think that they know something that I don't, and that they're kind of poking fun at the viewer, which I think is a criticism in a lot of contemporary art, that my kid could do that, and so why is this important? What do they know that I don't know?
So you're the artist, Jill. Can we do that with confidence that we're not being the butt of the artist joke?
I don't know that you can do it necessarily, but I think for your own personal appreciation, if you give them the benefit of the doubt, because it's really a subjective thing. They could be making fun or they might not be, but if you want to enhance your own viewing of it and look at it as it's something sincere, I think you can get a lot more out of it.
Jill, I love hearing from you and so happy to be in your studio. Let me get one more. Chris in Boston. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Warhol's work, have been for a lot of years. I've seen a lot of art, a lot of galleries, whatnot, and my comment about Warhol is simply that of all the art that I've ever seen, as far as I know, his is the only art where the images that he's depicted, he's the most self-referential artist that I know of. That, you know, now I can't look at a Coke bottle or a Campbell soup can without thinking about Warhol right away. And I can't think of any other artist that's done that, even in the pop art realm. You know, there's still sort of a couple of steps. You know, you look at a Lichtenstein, and then I think about Jack Kirby and Dots, and then I, you know, it's just with Warhol, his work has this ability to, anything that he touched puts this aura of him around it and has stayed there.
Well, he invaded our everyday environment with that perspective, didn't he? And there it is. Chris, I appreciate your call as well. Peter Sheldahl, that reality collapsing into the appearance of reality, is that still where we stand? What does it mean about how we connect
to
the world?
That's a sort of general condition in which we are perhaps trying each in our own way to escape from and deal with. I like nature. I like trees and streams and wild turkeys. But
he brought you a soup can.
I like soup. I mean, it's and he made the point that if you like it once, you're going to like it again. I mean, it's the world of commodities, which is identical units of things. Anyway, where we are.
Yeah, 20 Marilyns, triple Elvis. At the Met right now, regarding Warhol, 60 artists, 50 years. Marla Prather is co-curator there. And Marla, we're really grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much. You're on. The show's on till what, end of the year?
That's right, December 31st.
At the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, regarding Warhol. Thank you so much. And Peter Sheldahl with the New Yorker Magazine. Always great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us today, Peter.
Thank you.
Go out with Lou Reed, with John Cale here. Hello, it's me, Lou Reed, former Velvet Underground frontman, big friend of Andy Warhol. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I guess we've got to go. I wish some way, somehow, you like this little show. I know this is late in coming, but it's the only way I know. Hello, it's me. Good night, Andy. Goodbye, Andy.